Welcome back to Binge Tested, a Ghostbusters podcast. I'm your host, Charlie Harsh, and this is the show where we break down the builds, the gear, and how to actually make this stuff better. Today's episode is all about leveling up your build. I'm joined by Ben Eady, a special effects designer and engineer who worked on Ghostbusters Afterlife. And what makes this conversation different is we're not just talking about what was used on screen, we're breaking down how and why those props were built the way they were. Because at the end of the day, whether you're building in a shop or on a film set, the goal is the same. Make something that looks right, feels right, and actually works. So we're going to get into the details that most builders struggle with. Lighting, sound, durability, wiring, and what really separates something that just looks good from something that feels real. Ben, welcome to Bench Tested.
Hey, thanks for having me, Charlie.
Absolutely, my man. So let's just get into it. Have you always been a Ghostbusters fan? Is that kind of, was this kind of a dream come true when you were able to get that gig?
So normally, I live in a city called Calgary, and that's not where films are generally produced in Canada. It's normally out in like Vancouver or Montreal, and that's where I normally work.
Mm-hmm.
And when Ghostbusters came to town, I wasn't even part of the union here in town. So I scrambled and thought, like, you know, how can I make this work? So, you know, I went to the union offices and, you know, made sure I could sign up. And then I went and applied. And it turned out that they needed me just as much as I wanted to work for them. So it was,
yeah. So a dream come true. That's awesome. So when you first came on to Ghostbusters Afterlife, what were you walking into in terms of the existing props and design? What did you know? What did you need to know?
Well, you know, I knew, like, when you start any show, everything's pretty secretive, and they generally will kind of almost keep you isolated for the first week or two to make sure that you're not going to jump ship and go and tell everybody, you know, about what's going on.
Right.
You obviously it's Ghostbusters, so you're going to have proton packs and traps and all that sort of stuff. And I was kind of curious as to, you know, what some of the new stuff would be. Now, I was brought in more as a person to manage all the props and stuff on set and to make modifications, you know, in situ. All the props and everything were made by different prop houses like ISS, Hand Prop Room. You had Thingergy, a whole bunch of other places that were making these. But, you know, I had to make sure that they were running in order to be filmed properly on set all the time.
Nice. So you definitely had your work cut out for you, to say the least.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
How much of your job was recreating legacy gear versus adapting it for modern filming?
I would say, like, if you look at Afterlife, I wouldn't say it's 50-50, but I'd say 60-40 would be like 40% was sort of new adapting things and making things work the way they should. And, you know, you also get to keep in mind that, like, say the older packs had, you could see how the cyclotron, instead of just having lights go, you know, on and off, they had an actual cyclotron on the inside. So there was sort of some updating that was done. And, you know, LEDs were not a thing back when they originally filmed it, but they are now. And, you know, trying to get that the right look between incandescent and LEDs for lighting can be a pretty interesting thing to kind of battle with. Like, it can cause camera flicker if it's not done right. And just knowing what you can do to correct that can be, you know, massive differences in what the camera sees.
See, that's something that I think a lot of people don't think about is yeah, it's like the hertz in those lights. Like, yeah, it can cause that. So how did you combat that situation? Was it literally just going back to the way things were and using, you know, like you said, the incandescent lights and regular old bulbs for that matter?
You know, using incandescents and stuff, every director of photography, any camera guy will want incandescents if you can use it. They're easier to work with. That being said, we did, you know, the cyclotron itself with the whirling light, we did have an incandescent on it and it looked really good. But, you know, going into the, you know, recreating or making new props, the proton pack that went into the Ecto, Peter White was the guy that basically designed and built that one. And we needed a lighting system that was way lower profile than that. And this is one of those where tongue in cheek, and I took a risk, is that we programmed up an LED lighting system with some acrylics with laser cut traces in it and stuff, and made sure that the LEDs would kind of have that warm glow and look of an incandescent, and hope that I can make sure that the, you know, the flicker of the LED, I made sure when we were programming it that you could change that. So like, you know, if it was running at, you know, 60 hertz at this brightness, I could also run it at the same brightness, but at, you know, to 120 or 240 hertz instead, so that you don't get any camera flicker. And so we ran this past the DOP, and he's like, I have no idea how you got that incandescent in there, but well done. And I just smiled and I showed him the back of it, and he was just like, okay, your point's been made. Because we had been arguing over whether we were allowed to use LEDs or not in a whole bunch of different things. And he was like, he was a staunch absolute no. But I wouldn't say I converted him, but I let him know that, like, with the proper nerd, you can get what you want. You just need the right guy to do the coding.
That's awesome, man. See, and that's the thing. Like, I saw when you were doing a bit with Adam Savage on his show, Tested, you took the whole shell off and you literally had a physical, well, cyclotron, to say the least. How difficult would that be for somebody who maybe wants to apply that same to their pack?
You know, it's not that difficult. And if you look on, like, you know, the different forums, like on, you know, Reddit or wherever you want to go, there are people out there. And what completely blows my mind, and I think I did this when I went and helped Adam build his own packet at the cave, was that when they put out the first video, Tested put out the first video, I think I counted there was something like between 15 or 20 frames showing that actual sort of that moving mechanism. And within days, somebody had posted some stuff on a Facebook forum going, hey, this is what I think it was made of. The guy nailed it. Like, he had the right parts. He had the right motors. He had the right dimensions. I was looking at this going, how do you pull this from 15 to 20 frames of blurry footage? Like, it completely baffled my mind. So there's a lot of people out there. Like, this is what kind of gets me, is that I'm a hack. I just happen to be able to get in front of the right people at the right time. If you have somebody looking at a couple of frames of video and being able to recreate it like that, I bow down to you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's correct, man. I'm telling you, the Ghostbusters community specifically, and I think it probably goes for Star Wars as well. I mean, they get down into it, right? Like, I mean, they frame by frame. In fact, Namake Wan, who is part of the GP Star group, if you're not familiar, they come up with and have the electronics for the packs that, you know, people are out there wearing at conventions and stuff. And he was telling me that he, too, was going frame by frame, trying to get down the exact timing of the sequence of the cyclotron lights and for the power cell lights. And, I mean, just those kinds of details. Did you guys have to do a lot of that in recreating these props for screen use, or did you have a pack that was from the original movies that you were able to bring on set to duplicate?
Well, yeah, we definitely had, like, you know, some of the, we had an original pack, but also keep in mind that, like, you know, I was nothing more than I wouldn't say nothing more, but I was the figurehead or the front facing person for a team of insanely talented prop makers and designers and effects people. So, like, I was really there to maintain and keep everything together. So they had access to a lot of these things, and they did figure a lot of that kind of stuff out. So, you know, I guess long answer is that, yeah, we did. But for the most part, when you're on set, you don't necessarily have time to run out to the hallway and check, you know, if that was correct or not.
Yeah,
there is a certain amount of run and gun that has. So you do a lot of that pre-research, you know, have your hands on it for a couple of days, take the notes that you think you need and pray that's enough for, you know, by the time they say rolling.
Yeah, no, for sure. So when you're handed something, say like a PKE meter, what's your first instinct? Preserve it or improve it?
You know, it all depends on the circumstances. Me looking, if I was for a movie and stuff, my first thing is how do I make this easy? How do I make sure that it's robust? Robustness and being able to, like once the cameras are rolling or once you're on set, it's very, very expensive. You got a lot of people that are getting paid an awful lot of money to stand around if you don't have something that works. So, a few things that I make sure that are done is like there's a saying called one is none. You never have only one prop. You always have a backup. Always, always, always. Two is minimum. Three to four is where you get comfortable. If you can have five to six, then you're golden. But it's always a balance of does the budget allow you to do that? So I guess in short would be that I try to improve it to make sure that it's robust. But sometimes you're given a prop that's already pretty good. So sometimes it's just a matter of mimicking it. But only having one is probably like that is probably the number one thing that anybody should ever take away that you're working on shows. One is none. It is such an important phrase to embed into your head.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to look at it for sure. And I think I probably have taken that to heart when it comes to in fact, I think I heard you say that in an interview one time. But it's true, right? Because I take that to heart when it comes to like my own pack, because when I was building it and doing a 3D printed pack, which is again what I've got, I didn't want like it's the same with when you do 3D print these things. I always make probably about three or four copies because
Yeah,
you never know like
totally.
when you're putting it together how many you might break in that process. So yeah, no, for sure, that's a great example. So and you've taken stuff off the shelf items and you've turned them into film ready props for somebody who's out there trying to get ready for a convention or something like that with their Ghostbusters gear. What's the biggest leap between those two worlds for people who want to stay film accurate and use the right stuff versus, getting something that's just off the shelf that they maybe can mod?
In the end, the biggest thing here is that you got to have a smile on your face. It doesn't matter if you've made it out of cardboard or if you got it at Spirit Halloween or whatever. If you're walking around with a smile on your face, you're doing it right. Now, the one thing that kind of makes me chuckle there is that you say screen accurate. Well, from one prop, you know how I say one is none? Not one single prop that we had was an exact duplicate of the other. Not one, right? So when they say that, is it screen accurate? It's like, is it screen accurate to the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, or sixth RTV? Because all of them had little unique bits that people like myself or Mike Evans, the RC driver, would have noticed. But you can dive into these details, but you're if that's your thing and it puts a smile on your face, awesome, dive in and dig in. But if you're digging in and throwing shade to people because they didn't get it screen accurate, you're just being a jerk. The whole screen accurate thing is a misnomer. It doesn't exist. And a perfect example is I was at a fair and I took the RTV that I had rebuilt. So it was a screen used RTV, put it on display, and some guy came up and I kind of wish that he used Paul Rudd's thing going, nice replica. He didn't, but he's like, that's good, but it's missing a few things. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah, because he had no idea who I was. And I wasn't, and again, I wasn't gonna throw shade and stuff, but he was starting to, I wouldn't say getting mean, but he was trying to show that he knew more about the RTV than I did. And by the time it was all done, I just said, like, you do realize that this is a screen used bit. And he was like, oh. Right? So like before you offer unsolicited advice, figure out who your audience is first. The two is that you can offer unsolicited advice, but I think again, in the interest of people's feelings or whatever, like people are doing this because they love it and they put a smile on their face. Instead of going like, that's incorrect, go up and look at it from a curiosity point of view and go, where did you find out that headlight was pointed down versus like being straight out? Because I thought on the screen it was straight out. So you've asked the same question or you've pointed out the same thing, but one is coming in from the, is this correct or not? Or I already know this is wrong and this is it. You can avoid all of that by just simply rephrasing your criticism as a question.
No, for sure. And with that said, what do you say is the biggest misconception that fans have about how these props actually function on set?
That they are robust and they're amazing and they look exactly like they do on screen. These things are held together with duct tape, spit, and a prayer. Right? It's so, you know, if people are, you know, they want to have a screen accurate one, cool. Then take that pack off your shoulder, smash it into the ground a few times, maybe get your buddy to drive out in the back there to drive over top of it, glue it back together, then come back to me. And that will be screen accurate at that point, but not until then.
So I guess it's safe to say that a lot of the scuffs and bumps and dings and stuff you see on it were probably a part of just being used on set.
Okay, so this is a good story, and I'm pretty sure I've told it before, but we got the receipt of the first packs from, it would have been the hand prop room was making them. Mm-hmm. And we're setting them all up on the counter to show Jason Reitman, make sure that, you know, they're gonna, you know, hit the aesthetic that he wants. And somebody bumped the table and one of the packs fell down and it crashed and it kind of cracked the corner a little bit on right where the bumper is for the cyclotron. And we're just, oh crap, we didn't have enough time to do anything other than put it back on the stand on the table, right? And so Jason's walking through and he's like, oh god, I love the beat up look of this one. It was the one that fell down, right? So, you know, we're freaking out thinking we're fired because we just screwed up a very expensive prop. And it turned out that that was exactly what he wanted. So, you know, afterwards we take all the packs and we throw them on the ground.
That's incredible, man. See, that's one of those things that you think you're like, man, let's put all of our time and effort into doing something. And then an accident happens. And then you're like, oh my god, if we would have known that the whole time, that could have saved us a ton of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, the wand or the thrower that is in the ecto, there's a piece of tape on the wand or the hose coming up to it. And the reason behind that is I screwed up and I forgot to bring one of the props to set for stunts, and they were shooting at the same time in this one area and they needed the wand, but I didn't have that wand with me. And I'm like, oh crap. So what I literally did is I went and found one of the least used packs. I cut the wand off of it with a pair of like wire dykes. And then I taped it onto the other one going, this should do. But it was early enough in shooting that I knew that there was only one scene that didn't have this one little nuance in the hose. And it was this you know, wrap of electrical tape around the hose. And it, what I thought was kind of funny is going back to people that are like detail oriented.
Yeah.
There were people that put that tape on there and I was kind of like, hey, I invented an iconic thing by screwing up on set.
Yeah. And you know what? It goes back to people really getting down to frame by frame, because mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine like that moment. How long would you say that was on screen?
The tape thing, I should have finished off the story, is that when you start out and you do something, you make a change to a prop, you need, you know, the continuity is going to eat you alive if you don't have everything kind of looking the same.
Yeah.
So I realized, since the only shots that we had taken with the pack at that point in time was when they were doing the test shooting of the proton pack at the oil refinery. So I knew that I could kind of get away with this. So I had to retrofit all the packs with this. So I'm running around to all the packs, adding tape to it after I taped the one on to the ecto so that everything would match.
Wow.
So it's not like it's just one or two frames. In the entire movie, you now see that, except for the one scene at the very beginning when McKenna's firing it for the first time.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. See, it's those little things that you don't realize. And just as you said, you probably would have never have expected that one little thing becoming now a staple onto every pack that people are building out there.
Yeah.
That's one of those. I would take pride in that, because, you know, next time you're at an event, you'd be like, yep, my mistake. That's it.
It's a happy accident.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Bob Ross would be proud.
Oh, totally. Totally.
I love that. So how different is something built for camera versus something built for real world use or cosplay that you've noticed just being out with fans?
So the dynamic range of the eyeball is entirely different than the dynamic range of a camera. So when you look at like an RTV that was used on screen, it looks goddishly overpainted and like overdone. You know how you look at something and it looks like somebody tried too hard to get the colors to look the right way? That's what you need to do to get something that reads nice on a camera. But when you make them for somebody walking around with their eyes, they don't need, the things to pop like that. So everything seems muted when you're looking at the props that people are walking around showing everybody at a Comic-Con. I think that's the biggest difference is that it's grandiose. Like, the rust that you put onto something, rust would only be like a couple millimeters thick normally if it bubbles up. But if you're doing that on a prop, you need something that's like upwards of 5 millimeters depth so it catches the light and shadows properly.
Yeah, you got to go kind of overboard in a way, I'd
Oh,
imagine.
totally. Everything gets overboard. And it's kind of funny. But again, that's changing year to year. Like every year, the cameras and the sensors and everything are getting better, so the less you have to do that. Sometimes it comes down to a lighting thing. Like even color temperature and using the wrong kind of paint, and you'll have a paint that fluoresces under the wrong lighting, and you're like, oh my God. And then paint department screaming in, trying to mute the colors.
See, and I that makes me feel a little bit better because I felt like on the 89 pack that I just finished, I say I finished it. It's turned into more of a display pack. I don't really have the motherboard or anything like that on it yet, but I took some Vallejo pigment and I was just kind of, dusting it on there, and then I noticed, damn it, I didn't knock a little bit more off the brush, and there was like an area that had a little, and that stuff, it's fine. It's difficult to get off if you have
Oh,
to.
totally.
And so, but after doing that, I'm in hearing you talk about it, now I don't feel as bad because you know what? It was for screen use. That's what I'll tell myself.
Or just, don't beat yourself up. The whole purpose of this is to, like, there's not enough happiness in the world lately, and it's one thing that's kind of driving me nuts is where people are like, it's got to be perfect, it's got to do this, or they need to criticize, and it's like, in the end, the person that is either getting this prop or is making the prop, enjoy it, enjoy the build. Like for me, it's less about the prop and it's more about the build. I love building things. That's my thing, right? So, once it's done, I like it, but I don't have a whole lot of props or anything displayed in my house because the fun for me was in the shop, not in the looking at it. But
For
there are other
sure.
people who like to look at it, and that's cool too. So, yeah.
And no, I'm right there with you. I think that is, for me, that's the fun part because I do get to get in there. I get to, get dirty and make something cool. And what's cooler than a proton pack? Let's be honest. I mean, that's
Well,
just
I'm going to
something that.
argue the RTV completely won my heart. That's what's cooler than a proton pack in my
Oh
eyes.
yeah. How difficult was it to get into making that? Because it looks like there are people. Okay, for example, there's a buddy of mine who is he's making an aluminum trap, which a lot of people know as the Hero trap. He wants to do that, but put it on a frame, an RC frame. That might be a little overkill. If you know what I'm talking about. But
Okay, go ahead.
no,
I
but
do
I
have some feedback on
yeah,
that.
no, but that's what I was gonna say is like, he wants to do that, but I would imagine in the movie it was probably just like fiberglass, was it not?
It wasn't fiberglass, but it was a lot of really lightweight castings and plastic, in some cases 3D prints. And the trap itself, again, this is one of those where, remember, I was more the curator than the maker. So the traps were made at ISS, or the RTVs. And where were the traps made? I think they were also at ISS. But regardless, a full aluminum trap weighs like 15 pounds, right? Yeah, sure, you can get radio controlled equipment that can, and shocks and springs that can hold that. But like, if that thing's traveling more than 10 miles an hour, it is damn near a weapon at that point. Right? So like, one is that, being able to do it without it dragging its butt on the ground is going to be a challenge. I'd love to see it. And this is one
Low
thing where
rider
I,
trap.
yeah, and this is one thing where I'll say, I don't think it can be done. I don't want to say that. That goes through my head, I'm not going to lie. But at the same time, that's usually the best way to light a fire under somebody to go, yeah, here, hold my beer, I'm going to show you.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that people do that. So, if I ever say something and you want to prove me wrong, come on, let's see it. Let's go. I love that.
No, and that's cool. I mean, you're right. I mean, that will spark somebody out there to be like, you know what? He says it can't be done. It's gonna happen. I'm gonna
Yeah.
make it.
No, and again, I know that it can happen. The biggest thing after that is that just remember that seriously, anything after 10 miles an hour with something that weighs 15, 20 pounds, you've literally got a rolling cannonball, and it's not as easy to control. Like, you can look at a car or something, but you don't have that kind of control on an RC like you do on a car sometimes. And
Yeah.
I just wish somebody gets hurt. That in the end, that's kind of where I'm going with that.
Yeah. No, for sure. And you know what? If you're gonna do something like that, be safe.
Oh,
Don't
totally.
put it in the hands of a child. We'll say that because that could be dangerous.
Yeah.
Now I heard rumors that one of the RTVs that you created or that was created kind of got a little ruined.
Yeah, I squished one of them.
You
Remember,
how did that happen?
let's go back to the conversation where I said one is none.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yep. There you go.
So what happened was is that we had an RC driver, but he had like a regular day job, and we'd hire him when he could come out. And the what was really cool is his job understood, like, you've got an opportunity to do a movie like this, and they let him basically take a whole bunch of days off that he probably shouldn't have. But we didn't
Oh.
have him that day. And Jason, we were out on a country road, and he's like, "This is perfect. Let's pull the RTV out and we'll drive along." And he's like, "Let's go get Mike." And I'm like, "We don't have Mike today." And he's like, "But you can drive it, right?" And I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "Yeah, we're gonna go down the road." And I'm like, "Okay, I can do this. I can go down the road." And he's like, "We're gonna do about 30, 40 miles an hour." And I'm like, "Oh no."
Oh my God.
So I just looked at him and I go, "Look, I'll try. I'm not the best driver in the world, but maybe a little more qualified than anybody else on set at the set that we were at." I found
Right.
out later that there was somebody that was more qualified that I should have gotten that was working in was he? I can't remember if he was effects or lights, but somebody was an RC driver and I really should have gotten him. Anyways, so here I am in a chase car, and we have the camera car beside the RTV. We're cruising down the road, and I hit a rock or something, and it popped underneath the tire of the camera vehicle and
Oh
literally blew
no.
up. Yeah, and I'm just thinking, like, okay, that was my last day. But over the headphones, because Jason and the DOP were in the camera car, I heard them laughing, and I was like, okay, maybe. Maybe. And then I just hear this, that was awesome.
It's
So
good to have somebody like that who's a little understanding, right?
yeah. So we picked up the pieces and stuff and went on. And as I'm picking up the pieces, Jason looks at me, he's like, "We got another one, right?" And I'm like, "Yes, we got another one." But I go, like, we can't do this until, like, here's the one thing that happens too, is that you'll find out a lot of shows will take those shots that are risky, and they'll put them to the very end of the show, so that if you're going to destroy something, it's going to be on the last few days. And if you get the shot, cool. If you don't get the shot, you can still work around it.
Oh,
So
yeah.
the last few days of shooting for effects and props generally are sometimes like you're the most tired, but also the most fun, because they're like, okay, so I want you to take this never happened, but like an example would be like, you take the RTV and we want you to go full speed into this wall. And you're like,
Yeah.
oh yeah, let's do
Man, so that I was going to ask about the durability, but I think we kind of, hit the nail on the head with that. I mean, how durable did you need to make these things? Obviously not to be ran over by a car, but there a lot goes into them, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, you there was let's see, so we had stunt traps. We had a trap that would a couple of traps that were set to snap open really fast, and a few traps that were set to close really fast, and other ones that had suspension that you could adjust so that you could, puppeteer it and have it bow down and stuff without moving forward. So, we had sort of a range of things to do, but the stunt traps obviously were more durable. They were literally rubber cast with a aluminum sheet frame just to keep them so that they would, you know, stand up and not flex when they're moving fast. And like these things could move. Like we're 50 miles an hour is not unheard of with one of these traps. And you know, if you have an accident at that speed, you know, especially if you go under a camera car, they'll blow up. We had a few rollovers and stuff, but they're durable. They could take a beating, you know, you glue it back together. And you know, going back to my other statement, you know, you want a screenwriter prop, then you know, bash it off the floor, get your buddy to run over it, glue it back to with CA glue and some duct tape, and then now you have a screen prop.
So I was going to ask too, you know, how, and even when you guys were doing this and you and the team, how closely did they want you to stick to the 1984 design versus what you were able to take liberties with, or were you?
No, we like there were liberties. Like you definitely wanted to stay within the right universe. And you know, this is moving forward. These are the old packs. So you do want to keep it as close to the originals as you can. That being said, is that you know, in this movie, because everything is like old and beat up, that's like for props and effects, that's awesome because taking a prop and beating it up or making it look worn is, I wouldn't say easy, but it's easier to do than like say a clean spaceship. You know, I worked on Star Trek Beyond and a clean spaceship and trying to keep it clean, like a guy with the wrong running shoes running across a white floor leaving a street can ruin a shot. You know, and like keeping it dust free and fingerprint free is a nightmare versus a beat up prop with like or a beat up room with a scuff mark on the floor. It's like, well, that's part of the story, so it's not a big deal.
See, and I love the idea that there are so many different, you know, props and stuff that you guys had to have on set. People who start to build these things and, you know, they try to replicate and again get as close to what they see on screen as possible. You know, and that comes down to when they're building proton packs or traps or what have you. If someone is building a proton pack at home, what is the biggest mistake that you see that instantly makes it feel less real that somebody could work on?
You know, in the end, again, go back to if it's putting a smile on your face, you're doing it right. If you say that you're making it less real, then, you know, I don't know. I don't think that that is a criticism that should ever be used, to be completely frank. You know, like you can have like a little beat up box with like, you know, a round pan glued to it, and some kid thinks it's a proton pack. That's perfect, right? So, you know, if you're going for screen accurate and stuff, again, I'm going to go back to if it tickles your fancy and you want to, you know, obsess over one particular pack on certain scenes, that's fine. But you know, just remember that that's your thing, not somebody else's thing. So there really is no way that you can wreck it in my eyes. It the only way you could wreck it is to, you know, try to steal the thunder from somebody else by saying that's wrong.
Exactly. No, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, there are people who will, you know, stand and die on that hill, that it must be screen accurate. But I myself am one of those folks that are just kind of like, you know what, be you. if
Oh,
you
totally.
if you want your stuff to be pink and green, then do it. If you want to throw down some caution tape, have at it, you know, like make it yours. And it's not the end of the world if it's not screen accurate, right? I mean, that's, I think a lot of people kind of get a little tied up in that.
Oh, totally. And you know, it's I again, you know, look at the whole storyline. At this point, you're looking at, you know, since like 1984, right? So we're talking like 50 some odd years, or just shy of 50 years, I guess. But you know, you've got 50 years of abuse or changes, or so who knows? Like, you know, you could even look at the different setups and somebody's invented a new tool that they think would have fit well in universe. That's cool. That's awesome. Tell me the story behind it. You know, let's see what that's about.
Yeah, no, I like that. Have a story that with it. I mean, that's neat. How important is like the internal layout of wiring and stuff like that when you get into building one of these packs to what you actually see on the outside?
I guess on a technical point of view, if you're doing wiring and stuff, is make sure that nothing is necessarily hard soldered onto a board. Always have, like, you know, if you have a bank of lights, have a connector to that bank of lights. So should that bank of lights go, you can disconnect it by hand and replace, like, always have a replacement piece that you can literally plug and play, like make it like Lego, mm-hmm. right?
So like JST connectors and terminal
exactly.
blocks and stuff like that?
Totally. Yeah, that for me is like super important. The other thing is look at, you know, the first one you build is never going to be the final one. You might be usable, but it's never going to be the final one. Look, you know, build it, learn the lessons. Like even halfway through, even if you're not happy with it and you think I'm going to throw it out, still take it to the very end, because all those little lessons that you learn while you're building it to the very end help you on the next build.
Yeah.
And save you from having to make an error and have to do a second or third build. You can do that first build where you make all your mistakes. Second build is where you do things feel better. And then the third build is like, you know, the best or whatever. But you'll learn all those lessons. And sometimes when you get through on that first build that you wanted to abandon, you at the end, you're like, this is actually what I wanted.
Yeah.
So, you know, had I abandoned it, I would have lost all of this.
Yeah.
So don't stop that. But going back on that is that take a look at the first build and go, what can I do to simplify this? Like if you have, you know, four banks of lights, can all those lights run off of one power? Can all of those lights run off of one microcontroller? Or would it make more sense to have each one on a different microcontroller so that if one bank of lights fails, you still have all the other ones still working? If you had all of them on one microcontroller, you might be screwed. Everything's out. It's like, you know, a blackout versus you've got something that you can still work with.
Yeah, redundancy, right?
Right. But, you know, is that your end goal? Like, you know, do you want something that's always flashing, or do you want something that's flashing perfectly every time? Because those are two different. One is showing me that you should build with one microcontroller, make sure everything's working in unison. That's the one microcontroller one. If you want something that's blinking all the time but doesn't have to be perfect, then use different microcontrollers for each section, because that way it's easier to just modify or pop out pieces if you need to do that.
Yeah. And when you guys used microcontrollers on set, were they like Arduinos or?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, and that's so easy, especially with AI these days.
Oh my.
You people can get into, they don't even need to know code. They can just go in and say, hey, this is what I want this to do. It's for this. These lights are plugged into pin A, B, and C. And then, bam, it'll knock out whatever you need.
Yeah. Like, you know, an example would be we did an advertising thing for Wednesday Addams. And we had Thing. We made a robotic Thing that could walk around, like a radio-controlled Thing, right? And I spent a lot of time coding and figuring out how to make all the motors and everything work properly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just before like the big launch of ChatGPT. So GPT comes out, and yeah, I've got a better background of what I actually want. Knowing what you want in the end is sometimes more critical than, you know, even getting started, just figuring out what that final objective is. But I went into GPT and I thought, okay, if I had the microcontroller, how fast can I rebuild all the code? And what took me like 2 or 3 days, took me like, you know, 2 hours. And
wow.
I was just like, oh my God, this changes everything.
You're right, man. I mean, it's incredible. And I think that probably just opens the door up for any of these props to just be so awesome. I mean, that people can take them to cons and they look like they just came from, you know, ISS or, you know, any of these big prop making companies.
Mm-hmm.
They can just knock it out of the park. And
that's
cool. How have you noticed like AI definitely has helped, you know, with things like that in the industry? Mm-hmm. Do you see that moving forward in a bigger way?
You know, not necessarily in the way a lot of people think. You know, everybody's worried about it, you know, recreating videos or doing like, you know, face changes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, it's used for that. And in some ways, you know, maybe it is the right tool to be using. But like in my sense, you know, the perfect example is what we just talked about is that suddenly, the one guy that wants to learn how to do microcontrollers, but it was afraid that he's not smart enough. And this is where everybody's smart enough to do it. The afraid is the key word there, right? You gotta, get over that fear and just dive in and figure it out. But that all being said is that suddenly it drops these barriers that were normally there. And these people can start creating. So, like, imagine having somebody that is amazing at painting and doing, prosthetics and foam stuff, but he doesn't know how to animate any of this, and he doesn't have anybody to help him with that. Well, now he does. So the barrier to some of these props and some of these effects and the creation of it has effectively gone away. There really isn't a reason why you shouldn't be able to go out and do this and, dive in and play with it in that sense. Use AI to, even do it to have doing a search for how to do a latex casting of somebody's face. If you do that in Google, you've got like, the first 4 or 5 pages if somebody digs that far, and you're not sure if any of those articles are actually going to give you the real stuff. Now, AI isn't necessarily going to give you the real stuff, but I'm pretty sure it's going to land you way closer to the target than Google would, a Google search would. So if you start, using these tools as they should, so use AI to narrow the search or help you out, then find out the exact video or something that you need to watch to figure out how to do something. That, yeah, the whole education thing is. It becomes so. I love it. I think it's amazing. It, at least on the, as long as you're not the they're thieving, ideas and everything from the world. And I've got my own thoughts about that as far as like say art and stuff. I agree that like, I wouldn't say stealing, but using somebody's look about a painting or something like that, and then using AI to recreate it. I'm not sure. I'm cool with that, but I also had a saying when I was going through college is that I was kind of frustrated. I was like any college kid didn't have a whole lot of money, and I had a thought that popped in my head, and I said I wondered what would the world look like if knowledge was shared and not sold, right? And we're kind of at that point where we are a place in the world where knowledge isn't necessarily sold. It's just a matter of how do you get to it.
No, that's a perfect example. I love that. And it's true. I mean, I have learned so much more than, it's kind of like the hands-on thing. There are people who, they may not be the readers, right? That not everybody likes to pick up a
Oh,
book, but
totally.
if they get, hands-on with something, I'm a tinker, I'm a maker, as I'm sure you are as well. You are. It is one of those things that you did, you learn more as these teach you. And I've noticed that for myself when it comes to coding and Arduino stuff, that I wouldn't have been able to make a lot of the props that I've made without it, because it's just a lot of that information is, we live in a time, thanks to, TikTok and just social media in general, that we would just want things like at a snap of a finger. And when we can do that, and without having to go, as you said, to maybe the third, fourth, or fifth search down on a Google search, I mean, if we can have something sum it up for us, I mean, yeah, that's a winner.
Oh, totally. Totally. And but you got to be careful with that too. Is it really a winner? Like, a little bit of due diligence,
Definitely. You gotta be cognizant of what it comes up with. Don't believe everything a computer tells you, right?
What?
Yeah, I
That's
know, right? Who would
crazy.
have thought? Who would have thought? What's your approach been to balancing durability and accuracy, especially for something that's going to be handled a lot? So if somebody's out there at a con and, they're going to be showing it off, what's your opinion on that?
This is not going to be the answer you expect, but it's the budget.
Budget.
The budget. So the thing is that and budget can be you can pay for things in one of two ways, is sweat equity or money, right? And with movies, if you're on a set and stuff, you try very hard to buy your way out of every problem you have. But sometimes these things don't exist and then you create it. So but in the end is that if you don't have money, you probably have a little bit of spare time and some sweat equity. So use what you have.
Yeah.
And that all being said is that look at like this is the end goal, and I've got let's say $100 to make a proton pack. A lot of people will be like, that can't be done. And it's just like I've seen kids make something out of cardboard and dollar store paint that honestly from 5 feet away you would think was a cast original.
Wow,
So,
it's all about
he
creativity.
had it was creativity, some glue and some paint, right? And so just look at what your final goal is, and like say I want to have a cosplay for Comic-Con that looks like Venkman. Then look at your budget and go, okay, so what can I do? And the budget again isn't just money, it's also like how much time do you have to build.
Yeah.
So and even something as far as I know somebody has a proton pack that could loan it to me that gets rid of that, but I have to do them a favor by helping them move a piano.
Yeah.
Okay, go move the piano and get the proton pack. There, object one, objective one is complete.
Yeah.
So just go at it from there. But yeah, in the end, really, it comes down to what do you want to see at the end, and how much money do you have?
Yeah. For someone who wants to get into more advanced builds, where should they start learning? Electronics, fabrication, or is it something else?
All of the above. Really, I think if you really want to build stuff, grab some tools, start gluing some stuff together. I started as a kid where, my dad had a shop in our in our in at our house. We had a fairly big shop, and it had band saws and table saws and stuff. And I'd go out there with scrap wood and just send it through the band saw and make squiggly cuts. What was I making? Nothing. But I learned how to use a table saw or a band saw at that point, right? So get tools, start using them, and just get in there and get dirty. If it seems overwhelming to do a proton pack, sure. If you're kind of an electronics person, then get an Arduino, a soldering iron, and some LEDs, and take a couple online tutorials. Do one small thing, and you can get that LED to blink. Cool. You've got the power bar. You've got the cyclotron lights. If you're going to do the lights on and off, you've got most of the proton packs figured out by that point in time. It's just a matter of do that same thing over and over again into each little section. Then look at, well, I want a fiberglass frame, but or a fiberglass shell. You can't afford a fiberglass shell. Well, then look online. There's a guy called Lost Wax, a YouTube channel called Lost Wax, and he's got free patterns for a proton pack made out of Craftstar or like EVA foam. It is freaking amazing. It is like
That's
it absolutely. So you're talking about dollar store craft foam and a free plan that you can get online. So you've got the proton pack, you've figured out the electronics. So you've taken that big, huge, scary build and you've broken it down to something you can do, get that early win, and then go get some craft store foam and some glue and you're off to the races.
yeah, I'm not sure if it's the same guy, but it's along those same lines. He did one out of I think it was out of floor mats or
Yeah,
some rubber mat. Was that the same guy?
I'm pretty sure it is. He lives out near Winnipeg. He's another Canadian, and I sent him some emails and stuff because I was just like, man, this build is awesome.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. And it goes to show, just the ingenuity and just the creativity that you can get out there from the hive. Yeah, you look at like the RPF or gbfans.com, that forum, or any of these. We've got a plethora of places to go these days, and it is so cool to hear that and to see somebody else coming up with something that, and that's the thing too. You would not know that that wasn't an actual, maybe a fiberglass shell or a 3D printed proton pack like that. It looks legit.
Oh, totally. Like I keep talking about the cardboard and paint. That was a teenager kid that I saw at Maker Faire a couple of years ago. He literally came up and he showed me his pack, and I'm just like, oh my God, this is amazing. Then I picked it up and turned it over, and I realized it was made out of cardboard. I'm getting goosebumps right now. My jaw just hit the table. I'm like, oh my God, when are you out of school? I've got some people you need to call once you're out.
That's awesome. Yeah, because man, it's people like that that you see who are destined to be a prop maker, or they can mm-hmm. work in film, or because yeah. it takes a lot more than, you know, screwing something together. You got to have that creativity.
You know, and here's one thing that I've seen happen a couple of times is that you have somebody that's really good at making, say, cosplay props or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they'll get into the movies thinking like, oh, great, I get to do my hobby for a living. But then they find out that, like, you know, the some of the people in the movies might not necessarily be the nicest people or people you get along with.
Yeah.
And they end up ruining your favorite thing, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if... I almost like a word of caution is that if you truly love this and this is your Zen place and this is where you go when the world's falling apart, I don't know necessarily if that would be the job you want to get, because you might end up ruining your one Zen place to go to when things get hard.
That's true.
Right?
That's true. Yeah. That is something that I think, you know, isn't thought about. And frankly, probably people just don't want to think about that, because it is, so it is fun to go and to work with those same people and, you know, have those things, but you don't want to think that, oh, this could be the moment where maybe we don't get along, or, you know, I don't want it to ruin it, you know?
No. And like, you know, everybody's different. Everybody's got different personalities, and that again, that's cool. You know, there's been sets that I've been on that I don't necessarily get along with people. The Ghostbusters set, like that's one thing amazing. It was like a giant family. Like, honestly, it was by far the best movie I had ever worked on as far as the background goes. Everybody's friendly, everybody talked, everybody had that same goal to, you know, let's bring this back to life.
Yeah.
And, you know, it shows. And I don't know if I'll ever get that feeling again on another movie, because it was just that good. It was like, you know, I had stood on the top of Everest kind of level of work.
Man, yeah. That's awesome to have that, because you think about all those different things. Okay, like for my perspective working in broadcasting, I was fortunate, you know, during my career that I was able to work with some people that I grew up listening to on the radio.
Yeah.
And you're right. You don't always get along with those people. But
no.
That said, it was an experience that I think I will forever take and will learn from. And it's neat because you get to apply that to something else. And that, you know, again, mm-hmm. the knowledge that you gain from that is something that you can always you know, work and apply towards something else, because you will find a way. there will be something out there.
Yeah.
I got one other question that just kind of comes out of left field, and this is, it's interesting. So I wanted to make sure I squeezed it in here, but mm-hmm. He asks, how did things get started? When you got started remaking the old packs for Afterlife, not the Phoebe Hero, but the ones that the OGs wore, how did Ghost Corps go to Sony and ask if they could yank some old packs out of storage and go from those, or did they make new ones based on references?
Oh, they went and they got one of the, they went to the prop archive. So yeah, Ghost Corps went to the prop archive. They pulled, you know, some packs. I always fear saying I know which pack it was, because invariably I'll probably be wrong. So they got one of like the original packs.
Yeah.
They got a cast of it. And that was, again, that was the hand prop room that did it. You know, I had gone out during the point where they started to build it, and that they were doing the casting and everything like that, just to supervise. But I never really built it. I might have changed some of the electronics and stuff on the inside later on in set, but you know, that was a build that was done by the hand prop room. But going back to your point is that they had the original pieces. In fact, Jason's got like an old stunt wand in his office, which is awesome. You know,
that's
and
neat.
It's all beat up and falling apart, but like, you know, it's just like, oh my God, just don't touch it. It's beautiful.
Did you like? I know that the prop store just sold. It was one of the props from that movie, from Afterlife. Mm-hmm. Is it crazy to see that's one maybe that you worked on or had something that you put into it to see it go for thousands and thousands of dollars?
I saw the listing. I don't know how much did it sell for?
Hold on, I'll tell you. It was, I want to say it was just under 10 grand, I think.
Oh my good Lord. Anyway, so again, that would those ones, those stunt packs, that was one where we didn't have appropriate stunt packs, at least ones that were soft enough for some of the stunts that that we were going to do. So in a me being completely freaked out, I ran to a friend of mine, Frank Ippolito at Thingergy, and I'm like, I got a build for you, and I don't know if you have time, but I desperately need you to build this because you know I've done a couple things around with Frank before, and I was just like, I need a stunt pack. Can you do this? And he's like, I've always wanted to work on Ghostbusters, so I'm gonna make time. So Frank, thanks for doing that. So it was one of his packs, and he went out and confirmed its authenticity from what I understand.
Wow.
But what you know, the one thing I'm curious about though is that there are certain things that like say at one point in time Ghost Core let one of the traps go for a charity auction, but I don't know where this one came from, and I'm not sure if they did either.
Yeah,
So
this one says it was a light up stunt Natrona one from Ghostbusters Afterlife, sold for 10,080.
wow.
Yeah. So, and it this yeah, it was one of the light up ones. Did you guys have were they all did they all light up or was
Yeah,
only certain one? Oh, okay.
all the stunt ones were lit up. It was one of those where I don't think we necessarily needed that. I told Frank, like, you know, first of all, we need the packs. We get them done as fast as possible. Here's the date. And he, you know, went the extra mile, made sure that all the electronics and everything were in there and working. So, yeah.
Man, that's awesome. That's super cool. And to know that you can just go back on that and look at something that you just grew up with in your childhood is
Oh
that's
yeah.
just neat to be a part of, I can imagine. If you
Yeah,
had to
and
give one piece of advice, Ben, to someone trying to take their build from good to great, what would it be?
good to great. Man, it's such a no, like, you know, what do you, I think the biggest question would be, what do you not like about it? Why is it not great already? And if there's the one thing, right? And this can be silly, but it can be something as far as like, it looks too new. Cool, go beat it up. Or like, you know, maybe, you know, the paint's faded. Just, you know, do that one small thing. And it's usually one of those things where it gets the ball rolling. So you might, again, look at that entire huge task and go, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to be able to make this to what I really want. Well, okay, cool. So what's one thing you can do to get one step closer? And once you take that first step, the second step's easier, third step's easier, and the next thing you know, you're sitting on top of a, you know, exactly what you wanted. So usually it's an analysis paralysis issue, not a, you know, go out and do it thing or what needs to be done. It's a matter of stop thinking about it and do it.
Yeah.
And I suffer from that so bad. Oh my goodness. I spend so much time fretting about what could happen instead of just doing the damn thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Adam Savage had put it a best way too when he was talking about weathering. It's sometimes okay, and most of the time it is probably the best thing is to step back, take a break, come back and put a different set of eyes on it.
Oh, totally.
You
Yeah.
know, and then it'll yeah, just go from there.
Well, I love, like, Adam and I became friends on that show, and that's that I think number one takeaway is you meet somebody like Adam and you realize that he's helping out with the death whistles and stuff. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. But
Yeah.
then, you know, you meet him and you end up hanging out with him and you find out that, like, yeah, he's exactly what you thought he was, and he's just an amazing human being.
That's
So
awesome.
I'm at his shop. And this literally is a pre-Adam and post-Adam thing where we're building his pack, and he has to drill out some holes to fit his cyclotron idea on the inside. And I'm like, okay, so we'll get into CAD, we'll get the layout properly, and then we'll center punch in. And he's like, screw that. And he goes, I think the hole's about here, here, and here. And he hand drills into this thing. And I'm like, oh my God, what if you drilled the hole wrong? He's like, then I fill the hole and make another hole. And I sat there and I looked at him and I'm like, my method would have taken about 3 hours to get this perfect. Your method, even if you screwed up, would have probably taken 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I was afraid to drill the holes. Just drill the freaking hole. Make that mistake. You know?
That is
And
so
then,
funny.
but ever since afterwards, I'm just like, I look at something and I'm like, is, how much time am I spending figuring out to make this perfect when I don't have to?
Yeah.
Drill the hole.
Drill the hole. I'm gonna make a sign. I'm gonna 3D print a sign that says drill the hole. Nobody
Yeah.
else is gonna get it, but I'm gonna know, and that's gonna be my motivation. I love it. Ben, it has been a pleasure. I appreciate you
Same
coming
same.
on. Thank you so much. What can we look forward to seeing from you in the future?
Yeah, as far as what you can see from me, there's nothing on the horizon that I can talk about, but it's not to say that I don't consult and help occasionally.
So stay tuned is the
Yeah.
best way to put it. Ben Edie, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. If yeah, we can get more from you soon. Hopefully, we'll stay in touch and
Oh, yeah.
we'll definitely get it out there. We look forward to seeing more from you, Ben. Thank you so much for coming on talking Ghostbusters.
Anytime.
All right, that was Ben Edie. And if there's one thing to take away from this conversation, it's that realism doesn't come from just copying what something looks like. It comes from understanding how it behaves. The way it lights, the way it sounds, the way it's built internally, all of that matters more than most people realize. And that's where builds either stay surface level or start to feel real. The good news is, a lot of what Ben talked about isn't out of reach. It's not about having a film budget, it's about thinking differently about how you build. That's what Bench Tested is about, helping you take what you're already doing and push it just a little further. I appreciate you being here. We've got a lot more coming, so stick around. We're just getting started. Right here on Bench Tested, a Ghostbusters podcast.